Welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast, where Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr interview leaders from the world's fastest-growing companies to get to the heart of what's really driving their growth. And now, here are your hosts, Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr.
In this week's episode of the Breakout Growth Podcast, Ethan Garr and I chat with Andrew Davies, Chief Marketing Officer at Paddle. So Paddle provides a complete payment infrastructure for businesses in a single stack. And Andrew says it's particularly valuable for product-led businesses. With experience that expands everything from co-founding his own startup to leading corporate marketing at Optimizely, we were excited to find out how Andrew is approaching his CMO role and working to drive growth at Paddle. So Ethan, what stood out to you as being particularly interesting from this conversation?
Well, I think both of us kind of picked up on Andrew has this kind of air of calm and thoughtfulness to him. And I think it really serves him well. It's always easy for leaders to speak at like conferences or get on a podcast like this and just tell you all the great things that are happening in the business and just gloss over all the chaos and that's really happening underneath. But when we hear the honest truth and sort of the obvious notion that fast growth is almost never going to be purely smooth sailing, it brings with it, I think, you know, this place from which you can really get honest advice on how to actually manage through it. So I think that calm confidence of Andrew's just made the discussion around these challenges that he was facing just feel a lot more actionable.
Yeah, I agree. You know, even though Andrew has been engaged with Paddle for a while or had been engaged with Paddle for a while before he joined as CMO, he's relatively new in the role. So what seemed to be working for him in the early stages is that he has a pretty solid playbook for driving growth that he's adapting into this position as he works to really understand the unique business dynamics at Paddle. But yeah, I love when you asked him about metrics and he was like, let's face it, tracking is always messed up. And yeah, I would say that's been our experience in most cases, and no one ever really wants to admit it, but you know, it's kind of normal for tracking to be a bit screwed up and that you need to dig in there and fix it before you can be really effective.
Yeah. And so I think that's what it was. You know, I think you and I both genuinely just enjoyed like the authenticity of the discussion, but it was really nice to, you know, from that kind of stage of authentic, genuine conversation to then dig into the specific areas of the business and really better understand Andrew's role as CMO and where he sees his own personal ability and his team's ability to really drive impact in the business.
Yeah, for sure. You know, Paddle recently bought ProfitWell for, I think it was $200 million. And it's interesting to hear about the challenges and opportunities of bringing those two organizations together. You know, I think Paddle already had about 3,000 customers on their roster. And so he's continuing to expand that business, and how he's doing that is going to be really exciting, particularly with the challenges of integrating a new business into that. And so I think until now, they have grown successfully with some just really solid, but probably simple tactics, but they recognize that they need to probably move into a more complex set of tactics if they want to unlock new opportunities and keep that acceleration curve on track.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely going to have his hands full. But you know, I think anyone who listens to this episode is probably going to leave with kind of two thoughts. And you know, the first one is like, wow, they got the right guy to do this. Andrew's got the right plan to keep that pedal down on growth and really drive the next chapter for Paddle. And secondly, I think most people who listen to this are going to go, wow, I learned a few things here that I can probably put into practice in my own business. So yeah, I thought it was a really good conversation. I always say it's like one of my favorites, but it really was.
Andrew's this time great. It really is.
This time I really mean it. But yeah, so let's jump in and learn more about Paddle and Andrew's role as CMO.
Yep. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we are excited to have you. Also joined by my co-host, Ethan Garr. Hey, Ethan.
Hey, Sean. Hey, Andrew. Good to have you.
So we're going to be talking about Paddle today. And I'm assuming some of our audience are familiar with Paddle. But for anyone who's not familiar with it, can you give us a quick introduction to what it's all about?
Yeah, of course. So we describe ourselves as the complete payment infrastructure for software companies. So when you start a software business, you've got to do a whole load of stuff, particularly if you're a PLG, to sell globally. So product-led growth, PLG. So that would mean things like subscription management and taking multiple currencies and multiple payment acceptance methods and dealing with fraud, dealing with chargebacks, dealing with sales tax compliance in every territory. And we put all of that into one stack, one tool, one fee, so you can scale anywhere in the world from the launch.
Very cool. And so is it similar to Stripe? Does it compete with Stripe? Does it integrate with Stripe? How do they work together or not?
Yeah, great question. Stripe's part of our stack. We're okay. a very large customer of Stripe. And really, okay. you know, if you want to start with Stripe, many people do. It's fantastic for so many different things, but then it's just one piece of the entire payments infrastructure. And so if you start with Stripe, you have to build out the rest of it on top of it. Whereas if you come to Paddle, we use the best of Stripe and it's part of our infrastructure, but we layer on all of those other pieces as standard, as default. And so, for example, you know, Stripe will be really good in certain territories like the US, but when you go into a different territory, we'll use a different payment acceptance method in order to make sure that things are flowing super fast and super cheaply.
So with that, one of the things I've seen, like looking around like Paddle's website and just in general, is you often describe yourself as a merchant of record. Is that a good distinction here? And can you tell our listeners kind of what that means and why that's important for them?
Yeah, that's a bit of a clunky phrase that's been around for, you know, probably 20 years now. And what that actually means is we're flash reselling the software from our customers. And so because we take legal ownership of it for that millisecond as it goes between the software company and the customer, we're the ones who have to deal with all the sales tax. We're the ones that have to deal with all the remittance to all the tax authorities. And so that's why we're able to take that complete ownership of that problem, because we're operating in that legal way.
Oh, interesting. So it sounds like you joined as CMO not too long ago. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your journey that took you to Paddle and what led you here?
Yeah, of course. I co-founded a personalization software company called Ideo, and we built that through many trials and tribulations to a business that we exited in November 2019. It was bought by Insight Venture Partners, and it was put into their largest wholly owned asset, which was Epicerver, a big .NET CMS, and we were the kind of personalization and analytics bit, the sexy bit on the front. And I ended up running their global corporate marketing, and we then went on an acquisition spree, and we bought five other businesses over the next 2 years. And so my last 2 years or so have been first selling in and then buying multiple assets, the biggest of which was Optimizely. And so then I led the rebrand of that entire group to Optimizely. And after we'd done that, I was looking around for coming a bit more early stage for a new fun journey. And Paddle came along, and I just loved the business and loved the team.
So it's interesting because just before we were chatting about a recent acquisition that Paddle made of a company that Sean and I are both fans of called ProfitWell. Mm-hmm. So just years ago, just a quick anecdote, my colleague, Nate Kapitansky, came up to me one day and said, "You have to watch this video from this guy, Patrick Campbell. It'll change your life." And this is when that company was called Price Intelligently. And watched this video and it changed our lives. We realized so much about how pricing was so important to the business, and we learned a lot. So it's interesting that I think that acquisition was fairly recent. So was one of the things that interested you in coming over to Paddle the fact that you've done a lot of acquisitions, and obviously they're in a mindset to do acquisitions?
Yeah, that was one of the reasons. I mean, if we boil it down to the principles, I just saw a team and a founder in CEO in Christian who were massively aspirational, had big dreams for this business, but also a business that had very strong unit economics and therefore would be able to go and attract the capital to achieve those ambitions. And part of that was inorganic growth. The ProfitWell acquisition kind of wasn't on the cards when I joined, but it was certainly something that, you know, I knew being acquisitive was a piece of the journey. And I think also my background in that was interesting to them, having been part of several previously. And I mean, this is a huge acquisition for us. $200 million, 85 staff. They've built an absolutely killer company, and we're delighted to have them on board.
So, sorry, Sean, I know you want to jump in, but you're usually the one telling me, I know you want to jump in, but I'm just so curious. Your role is Chief Marketing Officer. What's the scope of that here at Paddle?
So I think about it as three concentric circles. In the center, there's product marketing. So customer insight, personas, positioning, who are we, listening to the customer. So that includes customer marketing, traditional product marketing, and also our web team. So building out a great web product, so our .com. So that's product marketing. Around that is then demand gen. So that includes all of our BDR teams. It includes ads, email, etc. Then outside of that is our brand team, which includes comms and creative and audience development. So it's the full gamut of marketing. And you know, the acquisition of ProfitWell has kind of increased and improved all three of those circles, particularly that brand play, because you know, one of the things that ProfitWell did so well, and Patrick does so well, is give back to the SaaS community, to the software community, through content, you know, pricing page teardown and protect the hustle and all of those shows they produce. And so that team, that media team's come on board as part of our brand organization.
Very cool. And how long ago did you start in the CMO role?
So I technically joined on the 1st of January, but I had been doing, I've been peeking under the hood for several months prior. One of the things I negotiated when I was an acquired founder was the ability to, you know, whenever I wanted to jump into, you know, role advisory roles, you know, part-time to look at other businesses. And I did that with 10 or 15 SaaS businesses. And Paddle was one of those before Christmas in fall last year.
Very cool. And then had they previously had a CMO when you came in, or were you the first one?
Yeah. They had a CMO who they parted ways with, I think, back in February or March, I seem to recollect. Lovely guy called Dave Rich, know him well. And yeah, they went without one for a little while. It was an interesting situation to walk back into a team that had been kind of leaderless for several months, and really build confidence in that team again and make sure that everyone knew that there was a direction we could charge into.
And I've been in that situation where especially when someone's moved on and you know, it creates kind of instability for team members and other things, to where they're kind of like, gosh, are you here temporarily? So what do you kind of, how, when you started, was it, I mean, as you said, you had some advisory upfront work, so you didn't just kind of come right in on the CMO role, but what did you really focus on in the beginning? Was it kind of getting buy-in from the team, kind of presenting a plan, learning, like what would kind of be those first few weeks?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, the peek under the hood was focused on demand gen. It was focused on thinking through their tactics and channels and the performance engine of the business. And you know, I think it would be fair to say that, you know, Paddle had grown extremely fast on a pretty simple tactic mix. And, you know, let's just use, you know, sample numbers, but, you know, yielding really efficiently $10 million of pipe a quarter is a virtue until your target's 40 million. And then suddenly efficiently yielding 10 is a curse, right? And I think they got to that point where they needed to build out more tactics, more channels. And so that's the bit I looked at first. But I mean, entering the business, you know, I'm always coming from the principle that I'm the dumbest person in the room. And that's absolutely true here at Paddle. We've got some super sharp people. And so it was all about learning and understanding. And then, as we just mentioned, it's then about building confidence in the team that are already on the ground, because there's some fantastic people who'd been here a couple of years, who'd been here through kind of a few, you know, different team changes. And it was about making sure they understood that they had a real part to play in this next phase of the journey. And a lot of their instincts were absolutely correct. We just needed to build a framework around it.
Yeah. So one question, and I apologize, Ethan, if this ends up throwing us off, if this is something you were planning to ask a little bit later, but I'm just, you know, the one thing that I have found more and more over time, that kind of product market fit, I think, is the biggest determinant on growth. Like, right product, right market, filling that void. Without it, you're gonna struggle for growth, and with it, that's gonna be pulling you in the right direction really well. But then the second thing is that growth does tend to be very cross-functional in terms of, you know, like if you're doing demand gen and you bring the customer in, but then the handoff is a bad handoff, and people can't, on the product side, can't really get them into an experience where they stick around. So as you described your scope, it didn't sound like product fits within that scope. How do you integrate with a product team to make sure that the ball isn't being dropped on that handoff?
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'd say a couple of things here. The first thing is that, you know, I walked into a business that had already 3,000 customers. It clearly had, you know, product market fit in certain segments. And obviously PMF is something that emerges over time because you've got to go, if we use the kind of crossing the chasm, the old kind of metaphors there, we're going from a beachhead through to a county, through to a country, through to a continent. And PMF changes as you go through. So we had some semblance of product market fit. And so it was trying to dig in and understand with the product managers what was working and then building a product marketing team alongside them. The other piece of this is really interesting though, because we are initially a sales-led business, but we now have a product-led motion as well. And so you can come and build, you know, build Paddle into your stack without ever talking to a sales rep. You can come and experience that. You can get into the sandbox. And when you pass our risk checks, KYB, KYC, et cetera, you can start transacting. And over the last few months, we've had, you know, hundreds of companies come and do that. And so that means we have to be even closer and tighter, to your point, with the product team, particularly that funnel of, you know, people coming in, using, getting nudges, understanding what the value is, and then actually transacting.
Mm-hmm. But it's the one thing one of the things I pulled out of that was that your kind of product marketing people do sit alongside the product team and hopefully help to ensure that it's not just a finish line for what marketing does and a takeover on the product, but they kind of help to bridge that gap. Is that the right interpretation there?
Yeah, absolutely. So those product marketers are sitting alongside product managers. They're understanding what's coming. They're understanding what's working. They're talking to customers to find out, you know, what the reactions are. They're talking to the overall market to see where we should be going, competitive intel. So that's absolutely that kind of linchpin role of the PMM.
What's been the biggest challenge for you in this early stage? Getting, you know, what's been tough, and what are you still working on?
I mean, boy. We're still working on everything. Nothing's finished. Nothing's done. I think some of the tough challenges here, you know, any acquisition just yields a huge amount of chaos. And so, you know, walked into seat, we raised a big Series D. We then, you know, did the acquisition. And now for the last few months, we've been settling those teams, kind of bringing them together. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of challenges you've got to think through there. So the integration of the technologies and the processes, but often more complex is the integrations of the teams and the ways of working. And in the first, you know, instances, people start to refer themselves as Profitwellers and Paddlers. It's a nice little shorthand. But then after a month or so, that starts to become divisive and not useful. And so the culture and people thing, I think, is just something we've got to keep working on as a business. I've seen it several times before in acquisitions. There's always similarities, but it's always some different shaped problems. So that'll be one. And then I think a challenge that every business faces that has scaled as fast as this one is its data infrastructure. It feels like we're always completely having to reinvent our core stack and making sure we've got to getting better dashboards that are accurate so that we can run and grow our business effectively. So those would be two. And, you know, I think going back to your point, Sean, on product market fit, one thing for me, in all the businesses I've operated in, a deep understanding of market and market segmentation is the first thing I believe all marketing is built off. And this business has grown through multiple market segments. It started off selling Mac software, downloadable Mac software. So not subscription, one-off payments, picked up a huge portion of that market. Then it went into subscription as well, and then not just B2C, but also B2B. And it's growing now into larger B2B customers. We've signed, you know, a whole bunch of interesting enterprise B2B recently. So we've got to evolve our product to match the needs of those emerging segments. And we've got to map where those segments are, the size and shape of them, to understand which ones we should go after. Because we've got lots of choice right now. You know, for example, we only serve software, a portion of software. We don't serve digital media or gaming or some of these direct to, you know, D2C type products. There's lots of opportunity there, but we've got to make those bets based on data. And so digging into kind of, you know, what are the size and shapes of all of those emerging segments is also a real challenge.
So how do you actually figure that out?
This business, a couple of years ago, they had some super smart data scientists. So we're doing all kinds of models and predictions. And I think that really worked to a level. And right now, like, I'm a simple guy. We're back manually eyeballing line after line, thousands of companies looking at, you know, their technographics, their firmographics, their, you know, will they match our risk profile, etc., in order to build an understanding of it, which then we will build some automation, some tools around as well. So I like to go back to basics on this. Put some smart humans against it, and then you can build data models on it in the end.
Yeah, so it's one of the I'm working with a company on this challenge right now, and it's interesting. As I kind of look through they use a lot of kind of NPS data, but it feels like it's sort of third party generated NPS data that doesn't necessarily provide a whole lot of kind of insight into, you know, ultimately for me, I think on the product market fit side, and I like the way that you describe kind of more the crossing the chasm where it's, you know, product market fit kind of one segment at a time, one product at a time. But ultimately to really validate that, it feels like you need to find the most passionate customers that really say this is a must have within that segment. And I'm not sure that your kind of your typical NPS approach necessarily helps to uncover that. And so I'm curious if you agree with what I'm saying there, and maybe I'm saying the same thing that you are, kind of in a slightly different way. But you know, does it come down to individual customers, or can you parse that through the data, or you know, ultimately, how do you know that a segment, you're getting enough traction in a segment that it's worth continuing to invest a lot into it?
I think those are great questions. If I roll back to Ideo, this was a B2B personalization engine. We stopped, this was about a year and a half before acquisition, and we stopped and we counted up how many customer types we were selling in our product in order to generate types of value, in order to kind of deliver, you know, to certain types of teams. So with those triples, we found we were serving, as a 50-person company, serving 15 customer segments. And we went into a darkened room, took all the data on the value we were driving, how big those markets were, the NPS, the excitement of the customers, and we deleted 14 of those segments. And we betted the house on enterprise tech B2B. But the interesting thing was, I think we only had one valid customer in that segment at that time, and it was the most difficult segment to go and win. But we knew it was where the biggest value was for our PMF. And we betted the house on that, and that led to us signing Salesforce, signing Intel, signing IBM, signing a huge number of people who are perfect fit for what we did. And the exit of the business was built on that really kind of, you know, swing for the fences. We're going to bet the house on going after one rather than spreading across 15.
So you found that really passionate customer, and even though the traction initially was small, you knew that it was a really deep market segment where you could build a great business.
Yeah, well, you can trade off all of those things, right? So this was, we had a little bit of validation that they were excited, but we also knew it was something that we could, it was a segment we could mine for years to come because it was big enough. And because it was difficult, it had enough defense around it because other people wouldn't attack it. And that proved true. It could have proved wrong. But I do think you've got to trade off all of those different things. You know, how close are you to it? You know, is it something you're getting massive excitement from? How deep does it go? And we had, after that decision, we had sales reps quit. We had product leaders who weren't happy and quit because they were betting on other different segments. But what it does is it means your product strategy becomes easy because you're building for mm-hmm. one customer type.
Yeah,
it means your hiring.
You totally preempted what my follow-on question was going to be, which was if you're going after four or five segments at the same time and they're focused on different benefits, how does that affect positioning? But the fact that you kind of ended up narrowing it down to one deep, more singular segment, then it keeps that positioning pretty tight.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, there's that phrase, flip the funnel. You know, instead of the traditional marketing, your old marketing, you throw out lots of stuff and then you go through the process of qualification, then you deeply understand the customer. We want to be in a situation where we're deeply understanding the customer and then betting every bit of our budget on going and finding more of them. And at Paddle, you know, it's a bit of a different challenge because we've got a much wider scope than I had at Ideo. But at the same time, there are some, you know, very, very clear characteristics of those businesses. You know, internationalization would be one. So, you know, businesses that want to sell everywhere, they have these detailed challenges over sales tax compliance that are really complicated to solve. So whether they're small or large or in different sectors, if you're internationalizing, that's one of those things that are true amongst all of our customer base.
So I think this ties in, this question will tie into that set of questions as well. But you mentioned earlier that when you join, there's sort of like a simple tactic that was sort of driving the business and demand generation. And it was working really well, but now your targets are getting bigger and you have to employ more complex tactics to do that. You mentioned as you're joining, you're thinking about culture, you're thinking about data. How much, like, you have a working, something that's working, your team understands how to work or build around this. How do you come in and bring that into the organization without it just getting so chaotic and so complex, especially you're doing acquisitions and other things at the same time? How did you, like, just from a cultural perspective, like, how did you personally try to lead that transformation without it just taking the wind out of the sails for the individuals who are trying to just keep the wheels on the bus turning?
Yeah, that's a great question. Firstly, making sure that at the top of all of the chaos, there's a couple of, you know, normally I choose three simple priorities for the quarter or the half of the year that everything ladders up to. And so even if people get lost in complexity, they can come back to that one slide. There's three bullet points that talk about, you know, what are the things we're trying to go at for this next 6 months. And also, it's about setting the expectation that it should be chaotic where we are right now, and that that's normal. I think often it's a mismatch of expectations rather than anything else. You know, my view of startups, my experience of growth stage companies, is that there's massive cognitive dissonance, because there's some things that are working and look massively fantastic and engaging and should be on the front of TechCrunch. And then there's all this other stuff that's, you know, horrific and broken and doesn't work and is dragging us down. It's like an anchor behind us. And part of the job of a leader in a company like this is to remind people that that's normal. And that's not something you've got to kind of win or lose an argument on. That's a tension you've got to manage, because there's always going to be that cognitive dissonance as you walk forwards.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and probably something our listeners should probably, you know, our audience is looking for. What are the secrets behind breakout growth success? And I think one of the secrets is it's not going to get less chaotic. I mean, you're trying to manage the chaos and you're trying to figure out what things to focus on, but you're not going to eliminate the chaos if you're growing quickly. And I think I think if you set expectations for people that is what, you know, that's what you're going to be walking into. First of all, it can be a lot of fun, but then it also becomes less daunting. And I think it also gives people more of that headspace to say, I can make mistakes here. Like, it's going to be chaotic. Things are going to go wrong, but we can, you know, we're a team and we'll figure them out together. So it seems like a really interesting time to be part of Paddle. So I think Paddle's, about 9 or 10 years old. Is that right? And, I think as companies get to that, you know, to that stage, and especially where you are, where you're really trying to explode even further, managing people, and I think you're 300 or 400 person team now as well, like managing the people and the processes, all of that starts to really come into focus. But good point that it's probably not going to get less chaotic in the process.
Yeah, I think in the middle of managing that chaos, I think one of the things that's really dear to my heart is that as you scale, you just can't be super prescriptive and super top down about everything, because my head would explode. I like diving into the detail, but you can't do that. And so, you know, the way I phrase it is that it's really, really important to teach people the rules of the game so they can play it themselves. And so the challenge here is, what are the rules of the game? What's our customer acquisition cost? What are the targets we're going after? What are the constraints we have to operate within? And then if we can teach our whole marketing team those rules of the game, then we get 30, 40, 50 people who are waking up every day able to play the game themselves rather than be told exactly what they should be doing for that next 8 hours. And I think that's part of that moment of unlock in an organization.
Right. Yeah. So I recently have been doing more kind of interim growth leadership roles. And so a lot of times the chaos is just pulling you into it. Like, you know, we have the, like, come and solve all these problems. And that causes you to kind of take the eye off of the big picture levers in the business. And so but as you said, you don't want to minimize the importance of some of the problems that need solving, but you want to empower teams to solve those problems. When you kind of think about, not necessarily just at Paddle, but at any business, like, the kind of what are the big picture things that you're trying to get working so that everything else kind of works a bit better?
Yeah, I break every company I walk into, when I'm looking at their marketing function, I break it down into four fundamentals. So, do we have a detailed understanding of our target market? You know, it has to be, you know, big enough to really matter to us, but small enough to go and win. Second thing, do we have an understanding of how we measure that? What is our operational framework for how much we can spend, how much we have to get back, what the key metrics are? Do we have a message that matters? The third piece, is there something we're saying that's genuinely resonating with the audience? And honestly, I find that to be the least optimized piece of most marketing engines. And then finally, like, the set of tactics and engagement plans in order to match that message to that target audience. And so it's trying to break it down into those four fundamentals and measure and improve them.
Yeah. And so take the measurement one, for example, because there's so many different ways to measure now. Like, there's off the shelf things like an amplitude that are going to make sense in some environments, not in others. There's, you know, just database with queries that you can run on top of that. And so when you, do you typically go in and find that that the tracking systems are where you want them, or is there some heavy lifting there to initially understand the business?
Hey, have either of you ever seen a tracking system you're happy with? A full funnel tracking system you're happy with?
I was trying to see if I'm the lone wolf and always being frustrated with that.
Oh yeah, I think that's a multi-billion market opportunity.
No, but I'm still hopeful every time I start working with a company.
Yeah, absolutely. No, not yet. We'll get there.
Always optimistic, often disappointed.
Yeah. So when trying to fix kind of the holes in the tracking, how do you normally kind of think about, like, sort of holistically what the tools for the tracking need to be, or do you approach it more from, these are the key questions that I need very accurate answers to, and let's get a solution in place as quickly as possible that will give me those insights so that we can guide our efforts better?
Yeah, I mean, if we think about the two timeframes of a marketer, the two timeframes of a CMO, you know, our first job is to build in quarter, next quarter demand. And the second job is to look 2 years out and build a position and an audience that we can then sell into that's 10x the size in a couple of years' time. And so most of the measurement is going to be around that first piece, in quarter, next quarter demand. And so, yeah, for me, this, you know, I love the SDR or BDR team sitting in marketing. I know sometimes people want to sit it in other functions, sales, but it sits within marketing here, and that's how I've usually run it, which gives you just a real sharp focus on all of your marketing activity. Because I want everyone in marketing, whether they're creating a killer media show, whether they're writing press releases, whether they're, you know, running blog posts, to know that at the end of the day, we're responsible to generate quality meetings for our sales reps to go and smash. And so, you know, building the metrics around that as the kind of lagging indicator, and then the leading indicators in front of that would be things like, you know, what are our response rates through our various channels? You know, do we have a well-understood target market with contact data that we can go into, you know, and all of those other things that then sit beyond that.
Yeah, and I think you were saying that you've moved more from a kind of pure sales-led model to one that's mm-hmm. a hybrid with product-led. Mm-hmm. How does the kind of SDR function? I mean, and maybe a quick definition on even SDR mm-hmm. for people who may not know the initials for everything.
Yeah, no, sorry, I'm acronym heavy. So we call them BDRs. We call them business development reps, and so their job is, you know, the outreach process via multiple channels into some of our target accounts to book quality meetings that are then handed over to our sales teams. And the interface with product led. I mean, this is a super hot topic right now. We've got a lot of product led growth businesses, you know, businesses that have founded like Monday and Asanas and things that do a lot of PLG that now have strong enterprise sales teams, and a whole bunch of tools now that are starting to bring the deals and the leads through that product-led adoption into an enterprise sales setting. We also have businesses doing the other way. So, you know, a client of ours is ServiceNow. They are very sales-led, and they're now launching product-led motions. And so they need ways of running that much more efficiently. And so, firstly, it's almost always going to be a hybrid. Whether you start product-led, whether you start sales-assisted, there's probably going to be a blend because of the massive efficiency that product-led adoption gets you. And in our scenario, that's what we're finding. And what we've done is created a revenue cutoff that if you're smaller than a certain revenue band and you try and talk to our sales reps, we'll just say, look, we love you. You're going to be awesome for Paddle. We're going to make, you know, a real great partnership together, but here's our self-serve approach. Now, you know, I don't think that's good enough yet. I want it to be the case where if you still want to talk to someone, we'll be able to do that. But at the moment, that's the way we cut it off. And then the opposite, if we find larger companies within that self-serve motion, right now we don't go and talk to them because they've chosen to be self-serve. And again, in the future, I think there's much more nuance around that, that actually there's some of those that might be accidental or it might be unintentional, and we really should reach out and present ourselves. So I think it's a very brutish revenue cutoff right now. And, you know, this is something that's pretty emergent for us. We're transacting huge volumes through it, but there's not a great infrastructure around it, and we will be spending a lot on investing in that over the next couple of quarters.
And are you able to use any signals in kind of interaction on even the kind of self-serve motion that end up saying this is a big opportunity and bring the sales in, but, or as you just said, if they've chosen self-serve, you leave them alone. How's that fit in?
Right now, if they choose self-serve, we leave them alone. And you know, okay, in a couple of quarters time, that won't be good enough. Because right now there's a couple of customers we saw come through and start transacting and transacting in very significant volume. So we're seeing the revenue run into the business and are thinking, scratching our heads, who are these people? We need to go and look through our data to find out. So it's a good problem to have, but one we need to get much better at solving.
And in the organization, sorry, Ethan, I know I'm just kidding. The organization, who runs the sales led end of things? Do you have like a chief revenue officer, a VP sales?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got sales leadership. So, Christian is the founder and CEO, and then there's a gentleman called Jimmy Fitzgerald who came in actually, which was ex-ServiceNow, is a very seasoned industry operator. He's our COO and president. He's who I report up to. And then several sales leaders also report to him. So we've got sales leadership on that side. And then the product-led motion is a partnership between the product team and the marketing team.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think particularly if you start sales-led, a lot of times it's really hard for sales leadership to want to kind of step out of some of those product led. So I won't go into the question there, but anyone who, unless you feel like giving some context there, but I think anyone who's kind of moving in that direction, some of the things that you're talking about, in my own experience, I think would be really hard in certain companies when it's a highly qualified prospect who's super active and they've chosen to go the self-service route. I don't know that I've ever worked with a head of sales that would say, yeah, we'll leave those guys alone.
Totally. I mean, let's name the elephant in the room here, right? We've got sales reps who have got commissions ahead of them, and suddenly there's a portion of the business that is cannibalizing the market they can go after. And that's extremely painful for any sales rep who's got a big target on its head. So totally understand is a big challenge. But the thing is, we can also all look at that as, you know, options holders in the business and fans of the business and participants in the success, that if we can start to do this and this motion can work and we can get correct territory assignments for our sales reps, then the business itself becomes way more efficient and way higher growth. And so it's about making sure we're all in front of that North Star for the company and that we do work out things for the benefit of those sales territories as we go.
So along those lines, is there a core metric, a North Star metric that really helps you as you and the business kind of stay focused on how to deliver on continuing to deliver value
and keeping all those people on the same page?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, our main metric is what we call gross transaction volume. So it's the volume that's flowing through our platform that we're taking our cut of. So our cut is usually about 5% and 50 cents a transaction. And so we're taking that off all the businesses that are using our platform. It might be slightly less than that if they're very high volume, I've negotiated something separate. And so that's our key metric on a daily basis. What's the GTV? But now it's actually getting much more interesting because with the acquisition of Profitwell, we've got multiple, you know, North Star metrics that we've got to rationalize. So as you probably well know, Profitwell has the largest SaaS metrics platform, you know, blew the other competitors out of the water. We track something like 26 billion of ARR through that platform. It's the most accurate. It's the most adopted. It's the market leader. It's free. And so we've now got a gross monthly volume, or gross merchandisable volume, the GMV, which is everything that's flowing through something that Paddle owes. But we're not actually taking any cut of that. Then we've got a portion of that that's flowing through Paddle that we are taking a cut of. But we want both of those numbers to grow. And then there are other pieces of the Profitwell business, like Price Intelligently and like their retention product, which is a more normally priced product.
So I think Sean and I always look at the North Star metric as having, it has value for multiple reasons, but one of the key ones there is just alignment throughout the organization. So you're making a good point that when you have an acquisition and you may, that can change like what the alignment is around. Do you feel like that's coming into focus now? What the combined North Star metric is so that the Profitwellers and the Paddlers are all aligned, or is that going to take some time?
Yeah, I think that that gross transaction volume is the primary North Star metric. It's what we all get paid from. That's the thing. And if we had a massive free base but weren't able to monetize it, then it would still be a valuable company, but it wouldn't be the same type of value metric. So I think we are all aligned about that. What we've got, though, is a derivative metric. We want to be a business. You know, we've got two strategies we could choose here. We could either be, you know, a kind of business that wants to own everything of a smaller portion of the industry, or that we want to serve as much of the industry as possible with a piece of what we do. And we've taken that second approach. And so we do want to measure things like the GMV. So we want metrics to keep growing as a product, because we want to be helpful to the SaaS industry, to the subscription industry, and make sure that we're measuring that impact by the volume of transactions that are flowing through our platforms, even if we're not monetizing them.
Right. And so I think in kind of bringing it all together, do you what sort of it taking a snapshot of kind of where you are right now? I think you've clearly, I'm sure it's evolved quite a bit from your day one there. But what are the challenges that you are focused on solving kind of over the next 6 months?
Mm-hmm. So if we just kind of take the problem statements that fall out of those metrics, I think helping our customers win is a really key one. If our customers grow faster because we take a transaction, or we take a percentage of their transactions, then we grow fast too. So that net revenue retention number is really, really important. And then also that second piece of the metrics is how we can serve non-customers as well as we serve customers. Now that's a challenge in the business. And we've stated we want to be the most helpful brand in SaaS. And that includes our shows, that includes benchmarking and reports and research and a free metrics product. We want to do more things there to help non-customers as much as we help our customers. So there's a few things there, but you know, sitting behind of that, I guess, is this, you know, the concept of the flywheel. Now, you know, I love, you know, how Amazon have managed to build year on year, quarter on quarter growth by understanding that customers want things cheaper and they want things faster. And all of their investments within that core business unit are about delivering things cheaper and faster. And so I think we've got a bit of a way to go to deeply understand what are those fundamental problems that we're solving for our customers, so that we can place all of our emphasis and investment on making sure those things are delivered, so that we can create that flywheel of growth by serving a big audience with lots of little things, and then a smaller audience with something that's genuinely impacting their business.
Can you sort of make that sort of into like a tangible, like tangibly connect that to like a like, can you describe a company like or a person who, you know, they're a non-customer where Paddle can serve them and then bring them into the ecosystem, then make them a customer, and then make and then bring them continued value. Yeah. Can you explain? Can you kind of make that sort of human
in
that path?
So you might be a listener to Pricing Page Teardown, which has now done, I think, 7 or 8 seasons. They break down pricing pages. Patrick does it with some other co-hosts. And that might just be you're a member of our audience. And so you're getting value. Every one of those episodes gives you incredible value. It gives you, you know, detailed philosophy on why you should be doing things, strategy on how you should price. So that's just, you know, the audience. Then you might say, okay, well, I'm using another billing platform. I'm not using Paddle, but now I want to get the benefit of the metrics dashboard. And so I'm now going to sync up my Stripe or my Zuora or my Chargebee into metrics. So I get this killer metrics dashboard. So up until that point, we're not taking a single penny from you. And hopefully we're delivering a huge amount of value. Now, there's some things we're building out of metrics over in the future, which are around benchmarking. Now, we've got the biggest data set in subscriptions. And so we can help you understand norm in terms of all your metrics and understand within your segments what norm is. So there's a huge amount of value we can deliver from that in the future, again, before we ever charge you. And so those are some of the steps you might want to walk through.
So I really like the that path, and I think a lot of marketers could learn from that you know, traditionally I think it's kind of like, you know, you put ads out there, you try to generate some leads, and maybe those leads are good enough to convert, maybe they're not, you improve your processes, but as you start to kind of stack almost funnels on top of each other, where you have a podcast, like you said, and then that podcast is leading to a free tool that provides a lot of value. You increasingly move people into a world where you have a relationship with them and earn trust with them, where you ultimately you can remarket to them for a long time and try to bring them into that kind of lead gen type state to where ultimately, and maybe even beyond the lead gen with the product-led growth, where it's you're actually driving the trial of it. But do you think most marketers kind of grasp that as a better way to drive kind of customer acquisition? And if not, like what's a good way for them to start to get started with benefiting from that type of approach versus a more traditional approach?
So I am seeing a massive shift in B2B marketing of people understanding that providing value is the best way of building relationships. And so I do think that we are seeing a turn where people are now not hiding value behind gated, you know, gated assets and big form fills. They're not locking those things away in the hope of generating an extra 5% of MQLs. They're giving that away for free. And I think there's a few trends that are sitting behind that. The first one is that I think buyer behavior is continuing to change. People demand much more. I want to go and try something. I don't want to be, you know, interrogated through a 15-minute discovery call from a sales rep on his diary or her diary before I ever get to see pricing or get to see what the interface looks like. So there's a buyer behavior that's going on. There's a competitive landscape where it's easier than ever before to start a SaaS business, and it's harder than ever before to break through into the mainstream by acquiring customers. And so people are giving more and more value away. So if you're a competitive set and you're not saying your pricing and not showing your interfaces, others are going to win and get on the shortlist in front of you. And so I think there's just, you know, whether you look at, you know, people who did this early, like HubSpot's website grader, whether you look at some of the PLG, there's a few PLG businesses now that are allowing you to experience the full value of the product without even taking an email address. And it's only once you want to save something or share something, they're actually collecting that data. So I do think we're on this kind of inexorable trend of giving value away for free in the hope of earning that relationship.
And I think HubSpot is such an interesting example there, where they started with that website grader, which was brilliant at the time. But the fact that they took that really bold move to say, we're going to have a fully featured free product for everything that we do, and just totally embrace product-led growth to where it's, you know, they've got the upsell paths, the cross-sell paths between everything. And clearly they've built a super valuable business in the process. And, but it's, I think there's a lot to be learned. Obviously they are aiming at a smaller kind of customer that is more of that kind of self-service customer. I think they're probably going a bit up market now, but traditionally they were pretty kind of very SMB or even small business focused, and where it would lend itself more to a no-touch self-service model. But it'll be interesting to see how much that does push into enterprise businesses. And I think you guys will be a good bellwether for how well that works.
I think so. And also one thing that's, you know, peculiar or interesting about Paddle, and certainly I saw this in the numbers when I came in, is our sales team talk about how we've got extremely strong second and third time win rates. And so we'll see a deal, we'll go through the whole process of mapping the value, doing an assessment of how much we can drive in terms of, you know, their growth, their cost reduced, et cetera. And we'll get a no. And then 6 months or 9 months later, that deal will be closed in 3 days, because now they've come back and they've tried something else or tried another approach. You know, we're starting to see that second time founders choose Paddle, because there's a whole load of complexity that we need to get better at explaining what it is. But it's really hard to understand how complex it is up front until you've gone through a few phases of that all, you know, trying to build, trying to break it, trying to optimize it, trying to maintain it. And then you look for a simpler solution. And so I think the relationship approach is also really valuable, because we know that once you come to Paddle and use it, you almost never leave. Like, we have extremely low churn. Once you've got a ticket to that party, you'll stay there all night. But the challenge is actually allowing a longer term relationship rather than just a quick pitch, to allow someone to understand that, go on that journey and say, well, we said these things would happen. Now you can see they're happening. So we're really open for that conversation whenever you're ready.
And I'm assuming that ProfitWell is a major transition point in the business to really embrace kind of that freemium. Yeah, it sounds like I haven't actually experienced their free product. I've experienced a lot of their content, but not their kind of SaaS analytics side of things. But that just really feels like it fills the gap that almost as embracing of freemium that HubSpot went through. And by the way, when HubSpot went through that path, I reached out to Dharmesh Shah and was like, I love what you guys are doing. I just invested, back. I had been a pre IPO shareholder through an acquisition that they had made, but I was like, I just got back in. I love what you guys are doing, and I think they over the next couple of years went up about 1,000%. So it was a good investment on that. Do you feel like that's a big transition point to embracing freemium for you guys?
It's absolutely huge. The other kind of facet or vector of the change we're embracing is also the integration into the ecosystem. So historically, Paddle has been a bit standalone, and we have to talk people through that full rip and replace, because we are, it's open heart surgery if you're a scaling business to put Paddle in, and it will solve loads of problems, but you've got to be committed to going and doing that. Whereas now with Metrics and with Retain, both from Profitwell, they're already integrated into lots and lots of other billing stacks, some of which are directly competitive to portions of what Paddle does. And we are not diminishing that. We're going to increase those investments and build out those integrations and make sure that as many pieces of our ecosystem as possible are integrated into the tools other people use. So I do think it's about freemium. I also think it's about open integration.
But I assume that they can still use you guys in a pretty isolated way if they wanted to have you serve all their needs, but then you can also integrate on top of other products. Because it feels like usually such a choice, either I'm going to build in someone else's ecosystem or I'm going to create my own ecosystem. But this seems like one of the few times where I see that you're kind of doing both. Am I misinterpreting that, or is that actually what you're doing?
Yeah, so you can effectively, if you're choosing to build your own payments infrastructure using multiple different vendors, and Metrics might be one of those vendors, Retain might be one of those vendors, and what Paddle Core is trying to do is replace all of those vendors with one single stack. And so it's going from piecemeal to platform. Because if we can do that, we can optimize it and keep it maintained and make it scale globally. And so there's pieces of our product, absolutely, that you can integrate in, the bits from Profitwell, and then hopefully an increasing portion of the market will choose to make that full replacement and go to Paddle Core over time.
So Andrew, I know we're getting a little bit short on time, and you told us that you have to run in a few minutes to take your team out for drinks, which automatically makes you a great leader. But before we wrap up, it sounds like, Paddle is an incredibly fast growing company. You're doing some exciting things. Are there any key growth roles that you're trying to fill now that you're in this, in your new position here, and anything you'd like to share with our listeners?
We're going to be continuing to hire in marketing ops, into demand gen, product marketers with payments experience. On the creative side, as we go into 2023, we're going to be building up our creative team. The team from Profitwell, most of them are from art school. They're not from SaaS backgrounds. They're storytellers, they're video producers. We're going to be hiring more people of that ilk. So there's a whole bunch of open roles there. And then on our customer side as well, a whole bunch of account managers, customer success.
So for our listeners, if they want to find out about those positions or get in touch, you have any recommendations?
Yeah, just come to paddle.com and hit the careers button, and it's all should be listed there. Or grab me on LinkedIn or on Twitter. I'd be more than happy to chat to anyone who's interested.
Great. So before we wrap up, Andrew, is there anything else you want to share? I mean, any one question we do like to end with is anything you've learned about growth in the last couple of years that maybe you didn't quite understand before, or anything else you feel like sharing before we wrap up?
I think one thing that, having built a business to exit, but at a small scale, we were 60 staff. Things were very simple still when we sold. And then being part of a roll up that went from 400 people to 1500 people over 2 years, mostly through inorganic growth, and then coming back at Paddle and seeing, an acquisition happen, is that, scale breaks systems. And the thing that I think I've learned over the last few years is that as you scale and as the complexity gets bigger, it's just about doing the simple things excellently and repeatedly. And I think, sometimes as marketers, we think it's rocket science and we'd like to pretend it's rocket science. And maybe for some people who are cleverer than I, it is. But for me, it's about those simple things, those fundamentals we've talked about. Do we understand the market? Do we understand the message? Do we understand the measurement framework? And can we go and deliver that message to the market? And so I think for myself, I'm constantly trying to make sure I come back to those fundamentals rather than get caught in the chaos.
So funny. I had a conversation about a week ago over a beer where a guy, quite a bit younger than me, but hard charging, doing great in growth and marketing, said to me, you know, how do you avoid becoming a dinosaur as all these new things are coming up? And my answer was almost exactly what you said, is that, you know, all these things have changed. The fundamentals don't change. You know, you need to service a need better than anything else that's out there. You need to understand fears and motivations and deliver value. And, you know, those frameworks don't change, and the tools to do it change, but, you know, don't lose sight of the basics.
Yeah. And I love just, you know, earlier on you said something, I wrote it down just because it really ties back into that. Like, cause I think, you know, it is chaotic. The organization's growing fast. All of these things are challenges, and it comes down to keep it simple, keep it straightforward. But you said, teach people the rules of the game and get them to play it themselves. I think that, you know, that's such an important piece of this, right? If you're growing fast, ultimately decision-making is going to get, it's going to get harder to do, and it can't just be the domain of one person or two people. So I think having that mindset of, we're going to get everybody involved in the organization, figuring out what's right, all pointing in the same direction, it just, it definitely resonates with me, and I'm sure with our listeners.
Absolutely. So thank you, Andrew, so much for sharing with us how you're approaching growth at Paddle. And we're really excited to see where you take it from here. And hopefully some of our listeners will jump on the opportunity to join the Paddle adventure there. Yeah, it's kind of a Paddle adventure, actually sounds like a good way to describe. But for everyone tuning in, thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thanks, Ethan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Breakout Growth Podcast. Please take a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. And while you're at it, subscribe so you never miss a show. Until next week.